Hello and welcome, and thank you very much for downloading this podcast. This is a Documentally podcast of Documentally.com, and today I find myself in a small village 10 miles south of Oxford in Oxfordshire, a village called Sutton Courtney, and I'm in a graveyard, funnily enough, and I'm now actually at a grave. I'm at the grave of Eric Arthur Blair, but you probably know him as George Orwell. And today, it's his birthday. So here we are, standing at the end of the reign of possibly Britain's most unpopular Prime Minister, Tony Blair, and at the same time, standing in the rain at a graveside, the grave of Eric Arthur Blair, English novelist, essayist and critic. You probably know him as George Orwell. You might even have read Animal Farm or the world-famous novel 1984. Today we've picked this peaceful place in the countryside, away from the glare of the ever-watching network of CCTV that riddles the country as a whole, to talk about Orwell's predictions of a surveillance society where liberty is constrained by a politics of fear and perpetual wars overseas. I'm joined here by John Perivolaris, who is an editorial and fine art photographer, connected with a few organisations over the country, and a person I met in Manchester at a recent symposium entitled The Democratic Image. John, how are you?
I'm very well, and a bit wet, but very pleased to be here on George Orwell's birthday to commemorate his memory and to be free, I hope. I'm looking around of any CCTV surveillance. I can't see any. We're in the old cemetery of Sutton Courtney, which seems to be CCTV free. Earlier, I got lost on the way here and went to the new cemetery, which I noticed is under CCTV surveillance. So I think Eric Arthur Blair is very lucky to be lying here.
There's also an ex-prime minister in this graveyard, I believe.
Asquith. Yes, I don't know where he is. I can't see him from here.
Yeah, I too went to the other graveyard and just above the sign of a certain Courtney kind of local council was the CCTV looking down upon me. I thought, oh, how poignant. But I think he's possibly had something written into his will. Because he did, I mean, he was very, very forward-thinking. He'd invented CCTV a long time ago, hadn't he?
Yeah, I mean, not only CCTV, but the idea, which is many ideas, I think, especially in 1984, which to me are astounding, how prescient he was in many ways. I mean, not just the CCTVs, but the idea that we would have a screen in every house, which in the book becomes an instrument of surveillance. And I think one of the interesting issues of surveillance, which we might not think of as surveillance, is the idea of user profiles over the internet, so, on which we spend a large amount of our days in front of screens, giving over our information, most often voluntarily, it has to be said.
Yeah, it's often said there's two schools of thought of how this should be approached by anybody actually aware of all this data mining and information gathering, and I believe you're at a crossroads at the moment as to whether or not we should just be 100% transparent with everything we do, or we should just try and kind of be a little bit restrictive in what we're willing to put online.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's the sort of my vanity or whether it's sort of fatalism, but there is a school of thought at the moment that maybe the battle for privacy is already lost, and that we should, rather than resist it, make the most of it and put our entire lives, in fact, a lot of us already are to a large extent, online and in view of everybody. For some, like the late French theorist Jean Baudrillard, this is actually a very good strategy, because his idea is that if everyone puts all their information, all their lives online. In the end, you overload the system so much that it might collapse under the burden of so much information, thus fulfilling, in a roundabout way, Marx's, you know, idea that capitalism in the end will collapse under the weight of its own contradictions. I'm not sure I'm entirely convinced by that argument, but
I wish it were possible. I really don't think that with today's computing power we can even begin to imagine how many processes are being done every second of every hour of every day. I think that years ago when we had the Cray MP32 supercomputers grinding away in their room, air-conditioned rooms, we thought that was pretty impressive. We have that kind of computing power, or pretty close to, in our homes now, and I think that if we all willingly submitted every single second of every single day in documented form on what we're doing and almost what we're thinking, I think they'd quite easily manage to at least archive it, whether or not they could process it. But and it's the bringing up your name and suddenly having who you associate with and all these webs of networks, and it's very, very easy for you to be implicated without really having to do anything. There's a case just this week of under 15-year-olds putting sexual content of themselves on their MySpace pages, which automatically becomes a part of your MySpace page, which automatically and technically makes you a paedophile. Maybe we should restrict exactly how open we are and who we allow into our friends' books.
Yeah, you may well have a point, but I notice that we both have Facebook pages, and what we say here will largely be distributed via that and via your own podcast. I think we might all be hopelessly compromised, and that it's a matter of being aware that we are, and maybe that gives you some measure of control.
I think that's the whole point of actually doing it and putting it out on the web. It's finding that balance between the ability to communicate to the world and pretty much publish to every computer screen that wants to have a look, and keeping it to yourself. I think it's important that everybody knows just exactly the state that we've got to regarding the state of surveillance. I'm not a paranoid person. I do have moments when I'm walking down the road thinking, wow, there's at least, I mean, in my town, I think 12 cameras I counted from one point, but in London you could probably be covered from every single angle quite easily. It's it is a kind of a moment stopper for me sometimes, and not that I think the person on the other side of the camera is going to be doing anything with his view of me, but it is very invasive, should I say.
Yeah, certainly. I'm standing here, actually. I've just noticed something very nice about Eric Arthur Blair's gravestone, in that it's very discreetly hidden behind a rose bush, which I think we'll get a picture of. In a way, this speaks volumes about Orwell himself, the way he... he didn't like to be under scrutiny and hid in many ways behind either rose bushes, which he was very much in favour. He planted them wherever he could. And I don't know if this rose bush here, in fact, was planted under his own instructions. I think it probably was. But the information we give about ourselves and our visibility, our public visibility, is something I think he was very much aware of and played with. From hiding behind rose bushes after his death to using pen names and keeping different aspects of his life very secret. He was a very secretive man. At the same time, what's astounding about particularly 1984 was that he predicted everything we're talking about today in terms of us being not only under surveillance, but all the 24 hours a day, and the information is stored in its entirety. In that respect, I think he's actually was is we're living in an age which is far more Orwellian than it is Foucauldian or you know, Benthamesque in terms of sort of panoptica and all the other theories which emerged in the 19th century about surveillance. I think Orwell had a suspicion of technology and an awareness that he was living in a sort of modern age where the technologies of surveillance would develop to the stage where we're at now, hence hiding behind a rose bush in an idyllic graveyard with not a sign of modern technology in sight apart from our little recorder.
How many pen names did he actually hide behind then?
Well, Orwell, he decided on after, I think, writing a list. The other thing he was obsessive about was writing lists. And one amongst his papers are endless lists of various things. And one of the lists is actually possible names he was thinking of using along with Orwell. In the end, he decided Orwell was the one he stuck with it increasingly. I seem to remember reading in Gordon Bowker's biography that he did publish articles under one or two other sort of pen names. So, yeah, we know there are at least two personae he lived and wrote under, and there are possibly more.
You are listening to Documentally.
At the moment, we have to contend with renovations of the local properties. It's quite a picturesque village. There's some really, really old properties here, and I'm kind of glad that it looks the way it does around the church. It's really idyllic. I'm dreading to see too much change, although I'm sure... Well, I know Eric had a lot to say, didn't he, about how things kept changing throughout his life.
Well, yes, I mean, I think he had a very idyllic view of Englishness and England, and he was very suspicious of modernity in many ways. And in fact, during the Second World War, one of the things he celebrated was the fact that if, the worst came to the worst, at least the war would have done away with horrible things like radio, cinema, television, and that people would go back to reading books and tending their gardens and keeping goats, which are all things he did. So, yeah, I mean, he, in many ways, even though he was a socialist, he was a great traditionalist and had a very romantic view of Englishness.
Do you think he was a technophobe at the same time then? Do you think that came into it at all? Do you think that's where he feared the powers that technology could have in the future?
I just wish that he were alive, although maybe he wouldn't wish that he were alive today. I think he could see the way things were going, but that technology hadn't... although it was accelerating in its developments at the time, hadn't reached that sort of dizzying speed it reached subsequently after the Second World War and during the Cold War. I think he from my reading, that he was more of a technophobe than than anything else.
And I didn't actually think to bring one today, but if anybody out there does know a medium who could possibly ask this to... George Orwell. Of course, I'd have to be asking Eric Arthur Blair, as he may not answer. You could always let me know in the podcast. Fascinating. It's mostly famous for 1984, yet 1984 seemed to come and go without too much trouble, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, he always defined sort of packaging and sort of media. He wasn't... he was suspicious of the media as well as part of these new technologies, which he saw as only serving propaganda, really, and totalitarianism. So in a way, it's fitting, actually, that 1984, the book, didn't actually fit into an easy sort of marketing package, which was really kicking in around from the early 80s onwards, with films coming out and a lot of advertising campaigns using the coming of 1984 as a selling point. And Orwell, I think, would have been very pleased that that actually their hopes for more sales were disappointed. And I don't know whether he would have been pleased. He was perverse in many ways. Maybe he is pleased. Maybe he's chuckling at this very moment, wherever he is, that so much of what he wrote about in that book has come true, including the irony of the departing Prime Minister's name coinciding with his own.
Blair, a name that we unfortunately shall probably not remember favourably, but who knows how the Spin Doctors will finish it all off. I wasn't sure whether or not Orwell named his book 1984 because he was writing and finishing it in 1948 and he just decided to flip the last two numbers over. I know it was, I think, eventually published in 49, but he'd finished it in 48, I think, so maybe he wasn't necessarily being prophetic.
He was very ill at the time, of course, with his chest complaints and bronchitis and, you know, in his tuberculosis as well. And I think he was so ill that the publishing date kept getting pushed further and further back, because initially I think the book was going to have an earlier year as its title. I think it was, I can't remember which one it was, whether it was 45 or 46, but it took him so long to write the book that in the end the year kept getting pushed further and further back.
What year would you have given it if you could have given it its perfect title?
I think he more or less got it right, in that that title, I think, is a good title because it not only does it point to the future, but it also points to the moment in which it is being written as being a moment in which all the things he's predicting are already in play, but it also gives the implies that it's not too late to do something about these tendencies, and that we need to be made aware. And that being a political figure, which, I mean, I think he's probably the major British political thinker, I would say, of particularly in literature, of the 20th century.
I'm keeping my eyes peeled around us because we are surrounded by a lot of trees and I can hear chainsaws in action, so just be aware.
I mean, what makes him such a great figure is, I think, that he not only anticipated a lot of things that happened in society subsequently after his death, but that he created great art out of them, that he took all these diverse elements out of his life and grounded them very much in England and in Englishness and in the English language, which was his great concern. You know, English as an instrument not only of producing beautiful language and literature, but also as an instrument of control, an instrument of propaganda. And we have to remember, you know, that he worked as a propagandist to a large extent, working on the radio during the Second World War, writing for left-wing magazines and newspapers. So I think it's the way he took aspects of totalitarianism and its attendant surveillance techniques, which he'd observed in different places, starting off in Burma, where he worked as a policeman, even earlier than that, starting in his public school experience at Eton. Subsequently, his bitter experiences in the Spanish Civil War, where he was placed essentially on a death list by the communists at that time, when that great purging of Trotskyists and anarchists was taking place in Europe. He coincidentally feared for his life even when he was in London. He thought, you know, Trotsky's got a pickaxe in the back of his head, I might be next. He always feared that he would be assassinated in London. So he had a very paranoid view of life, founded on his experience. Maybe paranoia is the wrong word.
Well, if anybody listened to my podcast Made in London at the podcast convention last year, where I was chased and ran down at the end of the night, you'd understand why I'm also a little bit paranoid when I'm in London. It's a big scary city sometimes, especially late at night. Some of the words that he came up with, back to his working in the BBC, for example, he was working quite close to a room with the numbers 101.
Yes, 101 was the room where the committee which decided on disciplinary actions at the BBC convened. So he stole that. I don't want to give the wrong impression. I think he was very happy at the BBC, but in a very perverse kind of way. He also observed in a satirical way the way a large media organization is able to control its employees and control its message. So I think he was very finely tuned onto that, which, you know, in another way is very, very relevant to our own time. When we talk about the feral beasts of the media, it comes out of an entire background of spin, control, controversies over tabloid journalism, whether, you know, the media, who are owned by very powerful men, are ideologically driven, and to what extent are they independent, and who are they serving? I mean, all of these were his concerns as well.
And rightly so. When we think of there only being five or so people that control the world's media, you've got to have a look at the people behind the companies, definitely.
Both Blairs, I think, were very, very media savvy in different ways. And I think, well, maybe that's their only similarity.
Mm, definitely. Although, a lot of people may wish the present Blair no more. He's already made it past Orwell's 47 years, as it says on his gravestone here. He seemed to fit an awful lot into 47 years, not even reaching his 50th birthday, and here we are standing at his grave talking about him in the year 2007, kind of half hoping that a member of the family might walk up the path here, but I think they all live a long way away now. It's kind of interesting to also know that he didn't really make an awful lot of money out of this huge body of work. In fact, apparently there's missing millions was talked about in a documentary not so long ago. What do you think happened to his income? Did he just die before it had time to be accumulated?
Yes, he'd had moderate successes, I think, both as a novelist and a journalist. But I think his career as a best-selling author started off with his last two books, Animal Farm and 1984, which had enormous international resonance in the way that nothing else he had written up to that point had. So I think he was just unlucky enough to die too, and we are unlucky enough that he died so soon before he fulfilled, you know, the great promise that those last two novels anticipated.
Well, I must say that I definitely respect his choice of words in so many of his writings, and I now am enjoying his choice of resting place. It's a wonderful place, and And as ever, the church is built very close to, in fact, next door to, what looks like a very welcoming pub. I think we should maybe... I can see you licking your lips at the maybe head over there now and drink a toast to the life of Eric Arthur Blair, otherwise known as George Orwell.
Yep, I'd second that, and we can drink a toast to the great man.
With the development of television and the technical advance which made it possible to receive and transmit simultaneously on the same instrument, private life came to an end. Every citizen, or at least every citizen important enough to be worth watching, could be kept for 24 hours a day under the eyes of the police and in the sound of official propaganda, with all other channels of communication closed. The possibility of enforcing not only complete obedience to the will of the state, but complete uniformity of opinion on all subjects, now existed for the first time.
I think I'm gonna crash.